Buddha, to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I've been talking about the coming due of weighty or heavy karma in the last two talks. In those talks, prepare the way for this talk. If one takes a premise that there is a real and fundamental evil, in other words, if one accepts the premise of original sin, then it makes sense that there would be a God who punishes. And who can, if certain conditions are met, choose not to punish, but to save. If one takes as one's premise original immaculacy, what is often called original enlightenment, it's the same thing. There is nothing from the first. There is no real separation from the eternal. The essential nature of all things is void, unstained, and pure. We recite this every day in the Scripture of Great Wisdom, the Heart Sutra, of course. That's what this is about. That the essential nature of all things, the reality, the true reality of all things, is the immaculacy of no thingness, the immaculacy of no separateness from our true nature, from infinite love, infinite wisdom. If that is our premise, then there is no need and no sense in punishment. Punishment makes no sense. On top of that, if you have the law of karma, then to put it in a coarse way, everyone gets what's coming to them. For sure, the law of karma functions inexorably. Inexorably means you can't do nothing about it. That which is set in motion will come to fruition. Every cause has its consequence. But how are we to view this fact of the inexorable law of karma? Clearly, we could view it as punishment. As getting our just or our unjust deserts. Or as reward. So in that view, wrong actions result in painful consequences, and the painful consequences of punishment for the wrong actions. I should say bad, because that's what it would be, wouldn't it? Similarly, if you're good, you get rewarded. So when you find yourself suffering, from that point of view, you must be suffering because you've been bad. And when you find yourself not suffering, you must be not suffering because you've been good. Let's carry it a little further. People who suffer are bad people. People who don't suffer are good people. Might as well throw in the delusion of self as long as we're taking a deluded track. The problem with this point of view, I mean, there's many problems with it, but it's actually not borne out in experience. What we find in our experience is that we actually have a choice to how we will view the coming due of karma. We have a choice to take it positively. We have a choice to look down and take it negatively. This freedom of choice undermines the whole concept of punishment and reward. Because I can freely take the difficulties and the painful experiences positively. Similarly, I can freely be a complaining, negative person, even in the midst of relatively easy and painless circumstances. Just as the Buddha could not find in his experience something that corresponded to the self, a separate self, so one does not actually find in actual experience, when one studies in detail, that there is reward and punishment happening, or punishment and reward. One finds that there is consequence to action. And that knowing this, it pays big dividends to pay very careful attention to what one is doing and the attitude with which one is doing it. For one will get the consequences of one's actions, one's choices. Now the way that we usually express, or often express, the taking of karmic consequence in a positive way is to say that we take it as teaching. We can take pain and suffering as teaching. We can take blissful, happy states as teaching. Remember the words of Great Master Tendo Nyojo to Great Master Dogen on the night of his transmission. Study in detail. Do not think it is easy. We're here to look within, to learn the truth about our lives, the truth about ourselves, the truth about the way the world really works. We need to study our experience in detail. Be careful that we do not put theoretical constructs and worldly opinions and points of view onto our experience. The truth is that if we're looking for proof of punishment, and if we're looking for proof that the world is unfair, we will find it all around us. If we're looking for proof of mercy and compassion, if we're looking for proof of the law of the universe, that without fail, evil is vanquished and good prevails, we will find it. If we're looking for proof of the proposition, in the end, no matter how hard you try, life sticks it to you. We'll find it. If we're looking for proof of the proposition, everything that happens is for my good, we will find it. So often, a master said, look with the eyes of a Buddha and you will see the heart of a Buddha. If we look with the eyes of true meditation, with the eyes of acceptance at our experience, whatever it is, we will find that there is compassion at the very heart of the universe. And it's because there is this compassion, and because it helps be reminded of it, we recite scriptures like the scripture of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, the litany of great compassionate one, so frequently. They help us look up. They help us trust. They help us see through the veil of old opinions, old emotions, stubbornness, pride, and ignorance. To the shining truth that lies at the heart of existence. If we take the proof, if we take the humanity of another person as proof that there is not this immaculacy at the heart of existence, we will apply the same standard to ourselves. Inevitably. We can't help but do that. if we try to see the Buddha in another, regardless of the external appearances of things, then we will make that effort with ourselves. That also is an ironclad principle. When weighty karma comes due, even the most enlightened person, even those who've gone furthest in training, will inevitably have their wobbles. It is very, very important not to superimpose the worldly religious and the worldly psychological and the worldly mean-spirited dualistic point of view onto others or onto ourselves when this happens. That another wobbles is ultimately that person's business. That I wobble is my business. If I catch myself in a wobble, or if another person catches me in it and helps me recognize that I'm wobbling, then my job, if I'm training myself in the way of the Buddhas and ancestors, is to make the necessary corrections as soon as I can. Why is this my job? Because if I go on wobbling, I'm just going on hurting myself. And I don't want to hurt myself in this process. I don't want to take a process that at that time, remember we're talking about a period when weighty karma is coming due, I don't want to take a process that's already difficult enough, already hard to bear, and make it worse through whatever form of pacing and thrashing around I might get caught in. A disciple cannot do a master's training for the master. And a master cannot do a disciple's training for a disciple. We each can only do our own training. Guru Master Moke again likes to say, the wobbles are built in. And this is a very good way of putting it. And another way of putting it is something our master talked about all the time. There are many twistings and turnings on the path. Everyone here will remember at Jukai, the Ten Precepts retreat, Master would take her, catch Miyaku out in one of the ceremonies and show people the bloodline of the Buddhas and ancestors going down through all the Buddhas and ancestors down to the present day. And she would talk about the fact that this was not a straight red line. This was a line that went back and forth, had many, many turnings. Part of the acceptance of our humanity is recognizing that if we undertake the very difficult process of genuine spiritual conversion, we're in for some hard times some of the time. And these hard times, depending again on the individual, varies a great deal. For some can go on for years. Perhaps for some they have to go on for lifetimes. But none of us gets off the hook on this. We all have to get put through it. And this karma coming due is an essential part of this process. I've often said that when a person becomes a monk, they are saying to the eternal, and perhaps we're fortunate that we don't consciously know it at the time. I certainly didn't. We're saying to the eternal, I'm willing for all this karma to come due in this lifetime, so that conversion can be completed in this lifetime, so that a load of suffering and misery and ignorance and delusion is not left for some other poor devil to pick up after my death. We're saying, I'm willing to pay whatever the price is, however great it may seem at times, I'm willing to pay it. We're taken literally. And I've never known anyone for whom life didn't get more difficult within a few weeks or months of ordination, and again within a few weeks or months of transmission. And certainly within a few weeks or months of having a kensho. We're taken at our word, even when we don't fully know what that word is or what it means. Something in us knows very clearly. And that's why we know this is such a serious undertaking, to become a Buddhist monk. A serious undertaking and the most wonderful path that one can walk in human life. And it is the most compassionate thing one can do in human life. To truly undertake wholeheartedly the cleansing and conversion of karma, to let the eternal help one in the returning home of all the spiritual need, the resolution of all the pain and confusion. This is the highest path of human life. even though to the worldly eye it may look foolish and dull. After all, what could be more dull than just sitting looking at a wall so much of the time? From the worldly point of view. In my next talk, I'll talk about the distinction that goes back to the very earliest period in Buddhist history between the Arhat and the Bodhisattva. And I will talk about the wonderfully illuminating insight into this distinction that River Master Jiyu shared with us in her teaching. Scripture of great wisdom.